Thank you, thank you. I'm not sure how many new people we have here today that are not familiar with our process, but just to remind you, your color group is defined by the color on your name tag, and we take turns every week bringing goodies, so the group, the color group for next week is the green group, and you're responsible for bringing those snacks and coming around 9:30 to help set up and tear down after.
Thank you, Bob. Before we begin the questions and discussion, I just want to begin or lead with a quote. I'm sorry, I can't remember who said it, but it's one that stayed with me all these years. That it goes like this: those who know their history are amazed by the present. Those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it again and again.
Oh, yeah. It must have been Glenn Beck.
It's not Sarah. So, questions, comments, insights that you gained from reading Diane's book, or something that was said, you made a connection you want to share with people? Or?
Yeah.
Tom?
I'd like to speak to the issue of narrative when it comes to story and history. I had an interesting experience a few years ago being able to be part of a group at a think tank in the Netherlands. It's an institute for advanced study in the humanities. And I was with a group that was working on the concept of history. And they came up with a very interesting definition of history. And to quote them, they said, "We're using the definition that history is anchored narrative." Anchored narrative. In other words, what history is that historian goes back and finds certain facts, but those facts can't just be left alone. They have to be strung together. And so what you string them together with is your story. And, you know, you can get the same series of facts and have three different people tie them together in two or three different ways. Yeah. That's the mystery of this whole thing. And so I was always troubled when I walked into public libraries and they said, "Well, the fiction is here and the nonfiction is there." You know, and I said, "Well, wait a second. There's an awful lot of story in history, which is supposed to be nonfiction, right?" In fact, the French word is the very same. They don't distinguish story and history. When you say histoire, it's just one word in French.
Yeah. Absolutely. I love that. Anchored. That's good. Yes.
Is there a secret to getting people to tell their stories? How do you elicit that from them? Does it take time? I found working with small groups that men were much more reluctant to tell their stories, and with the women, only on a one-on-one basis could you really get into anything deep. Is there a secret?
There are several secrets, and thank you for letting me step into that. First, I'll leave with the story. When I was working in Officer Religious Ed, one of my colleagues came directly from the Philippines, and she was brand new in the office. And as you know, we have a certain slangs here in California. And one of them is, "Hi, how's it going?" Okay. Well, we had these little cubicles. And Irma was in her cubicle. Actually, it was more of a larger office for her. And we'd go walk by and say, "Hi, Irma, how's it going?" We keep going. And she'd turn around and get ready to answer the question. And we were gone. And the first 2 weeks, she thought it was a practical joke on her because she was a new employee. Finally, thank God she had enough self-esteem and courage, she asked one of us, she says, "When are you going to stop the jokes?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And she used that example, and we said, "We apologize." "No, no, in California, when you say, 'How's it going?' we don't expect an answer." It's kind of like, hello, you know? But so it's one thing understanding the culture and person's coming from, and certainly the age would be a factor, and as you alluded to, the gender. But with men, we men have learned several categories of how to respond to a question. And so this is why it helps you to know the man or the context in which he's in. In other words, do you want just the facts, ma'am? I'll answer to you in one sentence. Okay? And like I found, when people ask, well, how was your vacation? I have four different answers ready. Fine. And I keep pushing and say, well, I did this and I did this. And still push on the third answer, you see. So with a man, it's having been, like say, in a workplace, you've learned categories of how to respond. So always lead with an opening question. Could you share something about your work life? Which is always a good opening for a guy, because that can be enough of an impersonal thing where he doesn't feel like he's sharing his feelings. Okay? Because we men get very frightened about being vulnerable, especially if we don't feel protected in the environment. In other words, am I going to get jumped on because I shared the way I feel, you see? But the facts, as I understand it, anchored narrative of my life, I can stand behind. Okay? So could you tell us something about your work life? If you in any way put the question forward in terms of ideas, a man will jump on that, but you won't get his heart. Mm-hmm. It'll just be either theology or philosophy or science or engineering, whatever he's proficient in. If you want him to talk from the heart, talk about things that mean the most to him. What was one of your most favorite memories about your wife? She passed away. Okay? Or something that your kids said or did that helped bring out the little child in you. He'll step up to that. Okay, you're welcome. This weekend I'll be leading a father-son weekend with my brothers and their sons. And we've been doing this for 17 years now. And the weekend is about telling the story. The story not just of being Clark or being male, but the ancient stories and myths we share. And we do it in ritual form, we do it in dramatic form, we do it in fun. But we've come to be able to move more quickly into that space because we've learned how to ask open-ended questions.
How many yes. are there?
Oh, well, not everybody can make it, unfortunately. We've got a few that are in college. But interesting enough, this is the best attendance we're going to have in a long time. So we're really excited about it. So it's every one of my brothers except two. One is in Germany, can't make it, but his son's going to be there. And then another brother who doesn't have any sons, unfortunately, he's in the midst of a move right now, both career and physically moving his house, so he couldn't come. But other than that, we're all going to be here, all men. So. Yes, Alex.
I like when she talked in the introduction, she says, she talks about spiritual amnesia. And she said, is spiritual amnesia a precursor to religious Alzheimer's, a fatal loss of memory for which there is no cure? That really resonated with me because I think a lot of the big diseases that we have today are really ways that God or the universe is trying to help us see what is actually happening to humanity. And I think we have lost our memory about who we are, and that's what we are trying to celebrate in the Eucharist. Jesus said to remember him, but we're not remembering what Jesus remembered. We're just remembering Jesus. And Jesus' experience, it was the experience he had of this intimate relationship with the source of his being, that is what he's inviting us to be in memory with. And in that union, what you were talking before about union, everything belongs. And so once we experience that, we know who we are. And then we act out of that. But we don't aren't given enough tools and resources or the emphasis on it to have us experience it, not just know it
exactly.
in our head, but experience. So I think she has something, I think she's onto something when she talks about spiritual amnesia.
Alice, I totally agree with you. I was really struck by that as well. The only reason I didn't bring it up because I would have gone in a whole different direction in terms of the presentation, and you only gave me 45 minutes to work with it. But now that you brought it up, I totally agree with this. But you look at the words, and today, unfortunately, we do have a dichotomy between these two words. Originally, they were put together, okay? And the ancient peoples wouldn't use the term spiritual and religious. It was one and the same. So the very fact that already we've split them, when most people use this language, they're talking about a heartfelt experience of the divine
versus an institutional way of regulating the experiences of the eternal. Would you agree?
Yeah.
So, when we had spiritual amnesia, which very simply means you forget where you've come from, and you forget who you are, and you forget where you're going. So I'll start with a story. It's a lovely story about this father who had a four-year-old son. Okay, and he and his wife had just given birth to their second child, a beautiful daughter. But because of babysitting complications, that he took the son home and waited for his wife, the newborn baby, at home. The doorbell rings and she's got the bundle there, and her mother has just dropped her off. And father and son race to the door, and they greet mom and baby. And of course, the husband and wife are very intimate in their joy and delight in this newborn bundle. And then the wife notices that her son is pulling her pant leg and says, "Mommy, can I see my new baby sister?" He hasn't seen her directly, and she's really touched by the request. And so she lowers the newborn bundle down to his height. And his eyes get really big. And he looks up at her and he says, "I want to talk to her alone, just me and her." She shoots up that typical wifely look to her husband like, "What's going on here?" And he just shrugs. So she thinks about it. It's okay, let's go in the den. So they all march in the den, and she puts up the newborn bundle on the couch and puts some pillows around. And she and her husband back up just a couple of feet. And he gets really close. He turns around and goes, "No, all the way out. Just me and her now." Well, now she's thinking sibling rivalry. Oh, my God. He's been hurt, baby. So they tenderly back up, but they wouldn't go outside the room. They stayed on the edge of the room. And he gets down right in his little sister's face. And he says, "Quick, tell me where you come from. I'm beginning to forget." We now know, at about the age of four, we begin to forget the in-utero experience. Okay? We lose the connection. If we can take that analogy, when you're disconnected from where you've come from, who you are, right behind it will come religious Alzheimer's. Now, I threw that question out to you earlier, but let me answer it now. Okay? I believe that we have two generations that are trying to wake us up and to see this, and to do something about it before we slip here. Okay? Do you know, in the last century, 95% of the wars and violence were caused by religion.
Yeah.
And she has that quote in there that a lot of people become so embittered by it, they say that religion is the poison of society. How in the world did we get there?
Wow.
Yeah. Okay? So, at its core, what spiritual amnesia is you forget where you've come from, okay? That you came, as I said at the beginning, you came from God. As John Donne says, is that we come from the mind of God, we're created, and we return back to God in the heart of God. And that's why authentic prayer is the same movement from head to heart. Isn't that a lovely insight? John Donne, okay? Is that it's always moving from the head to the heart. This wonderful ongoing circle, all right? So, to reverse this, we are to get back to experiences, there's a key word, experiences of our own creation story. In other words, to be reconnected by experience. Not more stuff, more knowledge, but more vibrant experience. The mystics call these ecstatic experiences. And that word very simply means, or comes from ecstasis, meaning outside of oneself, or some would translate it beside oneself. All right? And this is one reason why today at this time we have so many young people experimenting not only in drugs, okay, but also different types of music and dance and different forms of lovemaking. Okay, whether you like it or not, these are very traditional ways that Native peoples work with and incorporated their religious practices. Obviously not to the degree we're doing it, because what's happened is we've lost our container, our religious container. Just because you outlaw something saying we're not going to have that here in this sacred space, what happens is you turn it over to the dark side and we see what's going on. Every religion, every organized religion has something that's not so sacred. It's profane. But that word profane, look at the language. We turn back to the words we use. Okay? The original meaning of profane was not the antithesis of the sacred. The original meaning was porch. In other words, it was the foyer, it was the entry point. That the profane aspects of your life were the entry point in which you met your Creator. Look at the Catholic faith. At the height of our, the center of our worship space, we have bread and what?
Wine.
What's wine?
An opiate.
Very good. It's an opiate. Okay? It's alcohol. It's a drug. You know? Ask any alcoholic. They'll tell you, it's real. Okay? We only have a little bit, though. Okay, the Native Americans, for them, it was the smoke. That's where we got the term holy smoke. That's where it came from. The idea was, a little bit is enough to touch the divine. To reconnect with the divine. Too much can kill you. Why? Because you begin to believe you are God. But just enough to remind you, you're in communion with God. For them, it was we breathe the same smoke. For us, it's you drink the same blood. Okay? Every religion has similar symbols. Too much, it kills you. Okay? Too little, you get disconnected. So it's just enough. A sip, a smoke. Okay? But when you look at our culture, what's happened is we've slowly shifted and we're right betwixt in between these two right now. And if you listen to the language of our young people, they're asking us to get back to this. Get back to the original experience of the Christ. Let me tell you a story that happened to me. Many years ago, I made an 8-day wilderness retreat. And the facilitators were schooled in the area of not only theology, but Native American practices, rituals, and ceremonies. And so I thought this would be a really good experience for priests to go through. So I loved it. It was a great experience. 3 days out in the wilderness by myself, and then what they call a sweat lodge. You know what a sweat lodge is? It's what we would call like a penitential practice. Okay. Well, the second sweat, you know, first sweat is prepare you to go out. And the second sweat is you come back. It's like a purification. It was so hot I didn't make it through. It was like four different where the door opens. Other than that, you're in there and it's dark. You can't even see your hand from your face. It's very hot and it's wet because of the steam coming off the hot rocks. So after three turns, I had to get out. I mean, I thought I was going to die. So I got out, and I was led, after they put a life preserver on me, I was led out in the lake. It was about midnight. And from the time I walked the edge of the teepee to the lake, I felt like, they call it the coyotes begin to talk to you. In other words, all the negative stuff. And I thought, I failed. I couldn't hang in there. I lost it, you know. So I felt like, in a sense, the whole thing was a wash. Right? We've all been there, you know that feeling. But so they walked me down the lake, they turned me over my back, and let me just float out there. And my body was so hot, that the steam was just rising. And there I was, in my head. I had moved from my body into my head, just in a matter of just like that. So I'm laying my back and thinking, God, all this time and prayer and effort and money and the whole thing, a waste. And then I opened my eyes. And honestly, there was nothing I did, but I saw the stars as if for the first time. And in that moment, I saw the next level. And everything made sense. It was like in that experience, that's what Alice said, I knew God. Everything came together. There was a real communion. Dark and light, heaven and earth. I lost all sense of my body. And what brought me back to reality was the voice of the leader. He was really afraid. I was floating out in the middle. Everybody else had come in. I had no idea what time it was. How long had been out there? I just heard his voice. Hey, Jim, are you okay? It's like, where am I? Is this a dream? Is this real? Yeah, I'm okay. I never forgot. That was many years ago. When you've had an experience of communion, an ecstatic experience, being outside or beside yourself, connecting with something bigger than you are, you never forget it. Mm-hmm. It will serve you for the rest of your life. In those first two centuries, did you know that no one was allowed to be a leader of a community unless they had an experience like that? Mm-hmm. They did not trust anyone without what today we call a Christ experience. In other words, they didn't trust the head. We can always fool ourselves. Today, unfortunately, it's the opposite. When I entered St. John's Seminary, for example, anyone who was involved in charismatic renewal was sent to psychologists. Now, thank God, we've changed. It's the opposite. For God's sake, please experience Jesus. You know? So that's what we're talking about here. Now you know why I didn't bring it in the full talk.
It's got to have been the experience that Jesus actually had himself, and all mystics have. Because, you know, we don't know exactly what Jesus was looking for before following John the Baptist and probably trying to figure it out for himself. But that experience, look what happened after he had that experience. Once you have the experience of that kind of union where everything's wrong, you're who you are, but you're in this experience of union, you go looking for it to make it real, to make it happen. What did Jesus do when he came out of the temptations? But to start bringing in all that had been excluded into his
Absolutely.
World. So it's essential to the spiritual life, but we haven't emphasized.
Yeah.
We've emphasized more than that. Yeah. Than we have that.
Absolutely. And his experience, theologians today are calling the Abba experience, is that he didn't know about God, he knew the Father. And he called God Abba. Okay? The most endearing term that a little boy could call his father, Abba. And for you call your mother Abba. Very, very intimate. And you're absolutely right. With that experience, you go looking for it. In fact, if you find this hard to assimilate, look at the most repeated myth in Western humankind, especially that's used in male initiation rites, and that is In Search of the Holy Grail. And it's all about this idea of this boy that goes out in search of communion. And he misses it the first time. Why? Because he listened too much to his mother and not to his own life experience. She said, don't talk to strangers. And he obeyed her. As a result, he missed out. It took him more years to get there. Yes.
And he kept his mother's garment.
That's correct.
Yeah. The working with people, there's a common explanation of the word spiritual and religious. And religious people are those who are afraid of hell. And spiritual is for those who have been there.
Yeah. Well,
which is confirming everything that happens.
Absolutely.
I've also experienced another thing. I encounter a lot of atheistic and agnostic people, and they've all had experience with religion, and all of a sudden they're growing again emotionally. And I find that in a strictly psychological aspect, they can grow emotionally.
Absolutely.
But spiritually, they're still back as as 7 or 8 or teenagers.
Yep.
And you talk to them about, you know, well, you know, what's your problem? And, well, you got, you know, the old thing, God's taskmaster and bad experiences, and why does he let bad things happen, you know? And I just say to them, you know, is that a very mature point of view, do you think? You know?
Yeah.
I said, when did you arrive at that point of view? And then they tell me, and then I leave them alone.
Yeah.
But that's a very common thing that happens. Is that they just don't get emotionally mature. And I agree with you, you know, to have this spiritual experience, you got to seek it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, I mean, I spent most of my life, see, it only took me like 50 years or so.
But
I didn't know it, though. But once I had it, I could look back on my life, and I had other ones before that, which I didn't recognize. My eyes were not open.
Yeah. Well,
to let it happen.
You know, we do a thing out of the Center for Action Contemplation that's international now. It's called Men's Rite of Passage. MROP for short. Have you heard of this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'm one of the four weavers, meaning that I help facilitate these internationally, and it is a blast. It's a blast. I'll tell you why. Because I've heard it time and time again from these men of all different ages, different cultural backgrounds, life experiences. We all come, and all we have is our first name. You know, I'm just Jim. Okay? And so we have CEOs, we want to find out at the end of the whole thing. But for 5 days, what they get is they get a reframing of the Christian story. and they go through the five different wheels, or pillars, or spokes, we're going to call them, of Christianity. And what makes this thing so powerful is just five things. One is tremendous amounts of silence. Most of these men have not had this much silence ever in their life. Two is the same home group they meet with, where the story of each man is heard with new ears. Okay? Three are powerful rituals. Not rites, but rituals. Okay? Fourth is the teaching, but there's only one teaching per day. Not lots and lots of yakking. The teaching is usually about 30 minutes. Four 30-minute teachings. Okay? The last one is the creation. Is it takes place in the midst of creation. A lot of these men, it's funny the question. It's like, well, are there bears there? No bears. Are we going to be okay? You know, a little boy is about afraid because we become so disconnected from creation. But those are the five components that make this thing happen. And the reframing, so many people, including priests, come to me and say, I never heard the Christian message so clear. Why? Because now they've experienced it here in the gut and not here.
Yeah.
Notice, four teachings, 30 minutes, that's it. The rest is experienced here in the gut. They stand before God. They don't need anybody else to teach them. God's the teacher. See? We've lost that connection. But there are ways that it's begun to be reclaimed. Somebody has their hand up over here. Yes.
Yeah, but you pointed it out. I was saying the people's longing to wake up from the amnesia is kind of evidenced in the popularity of meditation and
Absolutely.
Prayer.
Absolutely.
It certainly worked for me.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, the problem is that for many of us leaders in the hierarchy is that we forgot that, bless you, that when human beings are children, it's best to teach them repetitive things because that way it gives them comfort. Okay, so like Hail Mary, Glory to the Father, different prayers, different songs. It's a good first step. What often happens when you don't have the next step, either adolescent or as an adult, that's where people remain stuck. But you move from the place of words to the place of fewer words to the place of no words. And this is what our people are wanting to reclaim, is a deep tradition of meditation, which is the place in between, and contemplation. Okay? And you're absolutely right. It's what we're doing in the seminary now. But I got to tell you, these guys are fighting this. It's funny to watch. Oh my gosh, yeah. It's like, silence, oh Father, again? Yes! You need it. It's a great tool of God. Silence is God's original language. So, yeah. Anything else?
You mentioned, in fact, you put on the board Abba and said that Jesus used to call God Abba. And it brought back to mind the first time I ever heard that word spoken in real life. And I have to tell you, it was a little girl in Israel running down the street saying, Abba, Abba. She emphasized the second syllable. But this fact that it was a little girl saying it, hello, why can't, you know, women be priests?
This little girl. Great topic. You know, it's a great question. It really is. Let me just say up front, it's not about defending one way or another, but I'm in an ongoing discussion with a guy who's a union psychoanalyst, and we talk about this all the time. It's something to chew on. He says, if you look at it mythologically, priesthood, male priesthood, has always been a priesthood of the day. Okay? Of the day, in terms of the sacrifice and what's done there. But priesthood of the feminine, or female priesthood, has been a priesthood of the night. So think of sun and moon. We do this when we speak about Jesus being the sun, Mary being the moon. Okay? So we have a little bit of a thread to that deeper mythology. Right? And this is his point. As we talk about it back and forth, I say, well, what would it look like? He says, I don't know. I said, that's your department, Jim. But think about, isn't it interesting that what in our culture women traditionally do in domestic environments, you know, setting the table, cooking the food, rubbing the wound, putting band-aids on, you know, saying, now you need to ask your sister forgiveness and all that. So sacramental. We've taken all of that from the women and we've said to the men, now you do it. Let me give you a simple example in seminary. Whenever I ask the guys, I want you to form groups now and I want you to share the, whatever it is, and then at the end I want you to pray with each other. My God, you would have thought I asked them to do something impossible. They won't touch each other's hands, they won't lay hands. I said, for God's sake, man. I said, you want to be able to administer the sacraments and there's touch in every single one, you won't even touch each other? How are you going to do that for the people of God? See? So maybe this friend of mine, his name's Robert, maybe he's right. Maybe the bigger question is not so much which gender, but which person has the gift to minister. That was the question in the first century. It wasn't which gender. It wasn't the education. It was which person has the gift. And then the community said, Jew, we lay hands on you, go to it. Okay? Claire, you've got the gift, here's what you're to do. That's how they did it. But once you begin to look at a faith doctrinally, and if you read the wider view of history, there's some sad cases. For example, did you know in Europe that they were male and female monasteries? These are called brother and sister monasteries. Did you hear that story yet? Mm-hmm. You have. Okay, let me repeat it. Some of you have. Some of you have. What happened was there were brother and sister monasteries. And what that meant was that there was a monastery of women and a monastery of men fairly close to each other. And they looked out for each other. So what the men couldn't do or wouldn't do, the woman would do for them and vice versa. And what it created, very interesting enough, was they had abbots for the men and abbesses for the women. And very known facts, so this isn't hidden in a footnote, the abbesses begin to have more power and influence amongst the people of God outside the monastery than the abbots. They began to get jealous. And so when they were overrun by the Visigoths, the monasteries were destroyed. Rome would only give money and permission to rebuild the male monasteries.
Oh.
And the women crossed the board and were let go. And these were very intelligent, gifted women, leadership and whatnot, were let go. And that's where that whole movement, the Begin movement, started. It was these women who had been let go of the monasteries. So you already see back then, you see the effect of when you have this anti-female or anti-feminine response in a large church. It's called pure feminine. So it's another way to say it is, ladies, those who are married, you know, it's very nice. Pillow talk, pure pillow talk. How you influence your husband just by talking at night. Okay? So that's why we were told, it's kind of funny when you think about it, here in the 21st century, we're told, you can't talk about women being raped. You say that to a little kid, you don't say that to adults. You know? But that's what you get. That's what you get. Got time for one more comment. 2 minutes.
Question.
Question.
How would you integrate into the seminary training the feminine?
Oh, we do it wonderfully well. I'm very proud of what we've done. I think we've got a long way to go.
For example, we teach prayer as artwork, creating poetry, certainly through music. I'll tell you the area the guy just will not go to, and I say, well, what about prayer as dance? They just won't go there. No, unfortunately, prayer as dance or body movement, they get really nervous with that stuff. But, like during IPSIF A, which is a whole, we call it diocesan novitiate, it happens after, or just before their second year of theology. What we do is we teach them, for example, Tai Chi, Christian yoga, teach them how to cook. So even in terms of the prayers, we hook them up with some of the feminine mystics. So yeah, we've done a long... I told the guys, I'll switch with you. I wish I had this training, this formation, because that's not the type I got.
Do you bring women into the seminary to talk to?
Oh yeah. Yeah, we have women on faculty, we bring them in. I bring most of the presenters in IPSIF A are women, because IPSIF B has to be priests. We focus on diocesan spirituality. But during A, they get lots of women. Normal women and women religious. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.